This is Dori Smith. Today, we're privileged to have on our Christmas broadcast of Regime Change Radio, journalist Dar Jamail. He joined us by cell phone from Iraq, where he is working as an independent journalist. Tell us, Dar, with the capture of Saddam Hussein, there were some immediate predictions by CNN and other news sources about the possibility that celebrations were to follow. Your dispatches home have not been reporting on celebrations. Talk a little bit about what's been going on.
Right after the news was received, there were demonstrations. There were pockets of demonstrations around Baghdad. A large percentage of the population of Iraq who suffered under his regime was, of course, very relieved and very happy that he was finally captured, eliminating the dark shadow that was still out there as long as he was at large. But really, the things that I know weren't reported in mainstream media were there were other pro-Saddam demonstrations all over the country, predominantly in Baghdad and to the north. In the more Shia south Iraq, there were some bigger demonstrations. I think the biggest was in Basra celebrating his capture, and that was maybe, I think, 10,000 people at the most. And I think that was the largest one in Iraq. But in Baghdad, there were none that were really big. I did see a couple of clips on BBC showing a demonstration, and it was comparable to the demonstration of when the Saddam statue was pulled down during the invasion, where it was more staged. It made it look much larger than it actually was. Some of the other demonstrations that were just as large were the pro-Saddam demonstrations, and I actually ended up, not by plan, but just by coincidence, being in an area where a couple of those broke out. They were really large. Even those sections of Baghdad had to be shut down because troops moved in and ended up breaking up the demonstrations rather violently. So it was definitely a mixed reaction, but there weren't like throngs of people, thousands of people marching down the streets, that's for sure.
And you've been writing home about some arrests and in particular what has happened in Iraq to some students. Describe that for us, please.
Yeah, what happened with that incident in particular, again, I was in an area just by chance doing a story on something else, and we were leaving the area where we were, coming back out towards Baghdad, and we were driving towards a secondary school, a high school, and it was completely sealed off by 1st Armored Division. There were helicopters, there were Abrams tanks, there were at least four or six Bradley fighting vehicles and Humvees all over the place, soldiers on the ground with their guns. And I went up to one person, one soldier, and I asked him what was going on, and he started to talk with me, and then a person yelled from above in a tank for him to not talk to us, so he promptly clammed up, and we walked in a little further and found another soldier who was able to speak with us, and a gentleman from Wisconsin, and he said, well, there was a pro-Saddam demonstration here yesterday by some of the students at the school, and they some rocks were thrown, and so we have some intelligence on it, and we have some people in going into the school right now to talk to the students. And the school was completely sealed off. We could see some students behind some closed doors, like some metal bars, waiting to get out. And just about then, they brought out 16 students, and they loaded them into the back of a big troop transport truck, and they hauled them off with a tank in front and a tank behind, a Bradley, that is. And then they let the rest of the students out. And just about then, they all came rushing out. They were crying. They were very upset. They were extremely angry. And we were right there at the gate when they came out. They crowded around us. It was obvious we were Western journalists. They started yelling, and so we very quickly got away from that scene and got a few blocks off and found a few other students, and they let us know what happened, that soldiers had gone into the rooms, dragged students out by their shirts, and handcuff or put the little plastic ties on their hands and loaded them up and took them away. And so we were going to get in the car quickly to get back into Baghdad to write up the story. And as we started to get into our taxi, some of the Bradleys drove by that were sealing off another sector of the school. and some of the students were throwing rocks at them, and they started firing over our heads, standing on the tanks, driving by, just firing over our heads. So we have a little bit of video. We were ducking behind the seat of the taxi. We were really scared, needless to say, and another one drove by, and he started shooting over everyone's head. And this is at a pedestrian market. He was basically shooting into the second floor of a pedestrian market. And then one last student was out there with a rock in the street, holding it in his hand, and another vehicle, a Humvee, drove by with a soldier on top of it, and he just pulled out his pistol and aimed it right at the student's head and then just kept it trained on his head as he drove off. So so it turns out, we did go back and follow it up the next day, and it turns out that they had indeed arrested 16 students for demonstrating pro-Saddam, but consequently, it was not violent. There weren't even rocks thrown at the demonstration, and so they were detained. One of them was kept overnight. They kept them in some little 1.5 by 1.5 meter cages, and then let them out after about 8 hours, and after asking them if their father was a Baptist and all this kind of stuff, when it turns out it was just a bunch of kids kind of screwing around having a little demonstration just because they could.
You had written home in your dispatches that these students had been on a sort of list, that the military had gone after certain kids. Tell us what you know about that.
Yeah, so what happened, and I actually even saw one of the pictures, but there was it was a demonstration of 40 students holding up textbooks, that they're old textbooks because they can't afford new ones, so they still have Saddam's picture on some of the pages. And that's what they were doing, and Iraqi police were at the demonstration, backed up by U.S. soldiers, and they had photos, and they photocopied the digital photos, and then went around with these photos in the school and got every kid they could find that they had a photo of from the demonstration, and they used that to go pull the kids out. So, and that's, I've heard of that occurring in other areas as well, so obviously that's the common practice now, of going and taking photographs of demonstrations and then going back with the evidence and collecting the people.
We've heard recently on this program from two Iraqi women, one a journalist, the other an art and cultural expert, and both women were talking about the dehumanization of the Iraqi people. What are you seeing there, Dar Jamail? Tell us a little bit about the scene that you're living in. Do you feel that there is a dehumanization process that's going on? And tell us what that has been like for you from where you are.
Yes, that's a very good question. Absolutely, there's a dehumanization process going on here. There's one of the most common quotes I have from people, and I've done many, many interviews for many different reasons and different situations since I've been here, and one of the most common quotes is, "Where are human rights?" I mean, for example, you can't demonstrate if it's about a topic that's against the American interest here in any way, shape, or form. There's a soldier that I quoted as I wrote one of my pieces from the demonstration I spoke of just a moment ago, and his quote was, "Anyone who stands in the way of American interests here will be arrested." And that's what I'm seeing going on. Anything, whatever it is, people are being herded around like cattle. For example, with the petrol situation, which I'm sure you've heard about by now, that the lines are just totally out of control, sometimes 3 miles long now. People are really, really upset about it, and it's totally throwing their lives in upheaval. And the troops have gone in, and there's Bradley fighting vehicles at all the petrol stations, and then troops trying to control it, stringing razor wire, and if people start yelling at them, they'll kick them out of their place in line, and this sort of thing. And in other ways, one of the main ways, though, is the home raids. They are going into home raids a lot of the time on bogus information. People will be upset with someone for something that happened, for example, during Saddam's regime, and so they'll go tell the Americans, "Hey, this person's a member of the resistance," and they'll go storming in these homes based on this sort of intelligence. And I get a story recently on a family that they went into the home. It was 10 at night. They kicked in the door. The people said, hey, look, we understand. You need to do search for weapons. Come on in. We have nothing to hide. They completely ransacked the house. According to the people, they stole money and gold. They made the women stand outside. This instance in particular, there was an old woman who has diabetes. I met with her after this happened, and a very old woman, and she was forced to stand outside for 5.5 hours in the middle of the night in her bedclothes. And because of her condition, she needed to use the restroom. They would not allow her to. She begged the students and said, hey, please just send a soldier with a gun with me to the restroom. They wouldn't let her go, and eventually she had to stand there and urinate on herself while they laughed at her. And the Iraqi translator working with the military laughed at her as well. So these home raids are going on every night all over Iraq, and this is the sort of dehumanization that's going on. I mean, that's a very large question because it's happening in so many ways.
Well, there seems, too, to be a vilification of anyone who's not somehow, you know, getting with the American program. I would imagine that's hard for the Iraqi people to do, given that this kind of entering of homes and arrests and targeting of people for all kinds of reasons there has been going on for just about a year now. We're now celebrating Christmas 2003. This conversation about an invasion and occupation of Iraq began last year at around this time. Tell us about that aspect of it, Dar Jamil, the vilification of the Iraqi people. Is this something that you can verify? And if so, what kinds of things can you invite us to do about it?
Yeah, that's another good question. It's made it really difficult for people who even want to try to work with the Americans because their heavy-handed policy is so widespread at this point that even if it's someone who does want to cooperate and help out, well, they probably have a cousin who's through a home storming has been thrown into jail, and they don't know where he is, and there's no way they can get in touch with him. And so they're desperate, basically, at this point to get their story out. The human rights situation is one of the biggest problems here. And what people can do is, and I've been gathering some information to try to send out on what people can do, and it's basically regime change at home. This policy is not working. I see it being stepped up on a daily basis, even just since I've been here, and it's just only compounding the problems and making it worse. Writing your senators, writing your congresspeople, and getting behind whatever candidate they really support in 2004 at home to just basically do whatever needs to happen to bring regime change at home, because this policy here that I see being played out on the ground, it's the raping and pillaging of a country, basically, a country that's already been suffered through the terrible war with Iran, then the first Gulf War, which infrastructurally did more damage than this current invasion, and then the sanctions were just absolutely abominable, and then now this, and now the Iraqi people are having to deal with this. And so anything that can be done at home to try to invite the UN in here and get this heavy-handed policy changed is what needs to happen.
You have also been posting on the internet at electronic.iraq.net, and so listeners can find your work there, and you are reporting from Iraq. I would imagine it's been pretty scary over there. How long have you been there?
I've been here a little bit over a month now. It's really, there's just no way to get away from the guns, the threat of bombings from people attacking the Americans. Every 3 or 4 days, I try to take a day and just not go out so much because, even just walking down the street to go to a restaurant, bottom line is any time an American patrol goes by, they're a moving target. I mean, that's what people are targeting with the roadside bombs. And then at the same time of that's going on, you never know. Their policy is shoot first and ask questions later. So if they hear anything that even resembles a gunshot, their current policy is they basically just open up. So anytime they go by, that's a bit unsettling, and I try to avoid time around our troops as much as possible. And they're in a really difficult situation. But, you know, even just walking down the street, I always, for example, on the sidewalks, I just make sure I walk on concrete and don't walk on dirt, because that's where they hide the improvised explosive devices, is burying them in little dirt piles on the side of the road often. So it is dangerous. Bottom line, being here, the security situation is terrible and continues to decline. Any day, walking down the street, you could be kidnapped, shot, mugged. If you're a woman, it's worse, because you have to worry about raping and kidnapping even more so. So it is a bit nerve-wracking, and it's definitely already been an experience that's going to change my life.
Now, Dar, I want to ask you a little bit about the casualties, but before we get into that, and I will tell you, we've had on people that have put together a report under the umbrella of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War and MedAct. They've been reporting on war statistics, and we'll get to that in a moment. But first, there was a program on NPR, a brief story about the fact that the U.S. military over there is getting showing symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, and that there have been cases of suicides, there have been cases of some of these soldiers coming undone, as it were. And I wouldn't imagine that that's not to be expected under the circumstances, that they've been there so long, they've been in a very confusing military process. Can you talk about that a little bit as it looks from where you are?
Yeah, absolutely. Basically what the situation the U.S. soldiers are in, particularly in Baghdad, is it's a low-grade street war. It's a low-grade street guerrilla war. They drive around in patrols, and they know they can be attacked any moment. Anytime they leave their base, they're wide open, and it happens daily. I watched some soldiers walking down the street about a week ago. There was some sort of demonstration in support of something the CPA was doing, ended up being a staged demonstration. But we watched soldiers walking down the street, and I was standing on a ledge of my hotel, and I saw this one soldier in particular, and he was walking down the street. They had dogs out sniffing for bombs, and this fellow in particular, he had this like twitch where his left arm was just twitching up, and his head was kind of ticking that direction as he walked backwards, kind of scanning the area. And, you know, I really felt sorry for him, because I thought, you know, what possibly more miserable job could you have than walking around looking for bombs, and as well knowing that anyone could shoot you at any moment. They must be under terrible stress. Their morale is very low. I've talked to several myself, and I know that most of them don't want to be here. They're just here because they sit, you know, say, quote, well, my boss told me to be here, so I'm here, and I'm just doing my job and trying to get out as fast as possible. So, yeah, they're under tremendous stress.
Dar, you also had reported that some of these soldiers were shooting Iraqis who were running away.
Yeah, this is a clip. It was either in Fallujah or Ramadi. I'm not clear on it, because each time I saw the clip on BBC, it was they said one town or the other. But yeah, it was a very unsettling scene taken by a Reuters cameraman, and there was a demonstration, and the clip showed people running. U.S. troops showed up on one end of the street, and people were running away down the other direction of the street to try to get away from them. And they were shooting. You could see the red tracer bullets going over. I saw about three or four bodies fall down onto the street. And then there was a little bit of footage of the aftermath, and there were just several bodies laying around the street from people trying to run away.
It sounds like we're going backwards, back to the way things were when we invaded.
It really is. I've learned that you have to choose your language very carefully, and the war has not ended. Just because George Bush did his fancy landing on the aircraft carrier and said that major combat operations were over, which is not true either, because there's been several since he said that. The bottom line is that the military is here. They're becoming more entrenched by the day. I drive by their bases in Baghdad, and there's sandbags and razor wire and concrete barriers and machine guns, and they're putting in new machine guns. And the patrols, instead of being two Hummers now, they're three or four, oftentimes with Bradleys. The war's not over. There isn't a state-sponsored army any longer fighting them, since the Iraq state has entirely collapsed. But it's people who, there is a resistance movement, and then a lot of the people fighting it or joining it are people who simply don't want them in their country. They don't want them to be occupying their country. So the war is still going on, and you know, I want to be real clear about that. And any hope of that dying down without a massive change in U.S. policy here is just a pipe dream.
Again, as to casualties, MEDACT and IPPNW, the umbrella group, which is a Nobel Peace Prize-winning group out of Boston, Massachusetts, that has been reporting on civilian and other casualties in the war, they've said that in this war so far, as documented through databases that are very carefully analyzed, that they're estimating that between 8,000 and 10,000 Iraqi civilians perished fairly quickly on in the invasion, and that overall, the death toll is looking like between 22,000 and 55,000 people on all sides.
I'll talk first about the toll taken on Iraqi civilians. That is the main reason why I came here, because that's what we don't get news on back home. And it's atrocious. That I've heard those statistics you said, and you know, my highest kudos to those groups for doing these studies and finding out this information. I think it's critical. I've heard upwards of 35,000 Iraqi civilian deaths as a result of the war and the occupation to this point. And it's going on daily, directly and indirectly related to the resistance movement and the fighting going on directly against the U.S. soldiers. One of the main factors has simply been I'm sorry, I just heard some gunfire. I kind of lost my train of thought. I'm up on the roof of my hotel right now.
Okay. Do you want to take a pause and see what's going on, Dar?
No, it's fine. It was several blocks off. It's just actually commonplace. Let me just back up with, for example, any time there's a resistance attack on U.S. soldiers in Baghdad, always innocent civilians that get injured and killed. You've heard of some of these bombs going off near the Hummers as they go by, and okay, you'll hear maybe one U.S. soldier died, maybe one or two were wounded, and then you rarely hear that, well, five Iraqi civilians were killed and 20 were wounded. That's happening every single day. And then as an indirect result, for example, from the terrible security situation. Robert Fisk did a story a little ways back, and he estimated that throughout Iraq, probably 300 people a week are dying. I think it may be more than that even. I don't recollect it exactly. And that would probably be a low number. I've been in some hospitals, and I've seen, I mean, people are still coming in. It's like it's the low-grade war. People are coming in from gunshot wounds probably by the hundreds weekly here. And so there's that factor going on. And then indirectly you get, again, from the lack of electricity, the lack of water, there's diseases, there's malnutrition, many of the same problems that were suffered during the sanctions, people are still suffering today. Most of the hospitals still lack all the medicine and all the equipment they need to do their job. So that's another indirect result. So as far as the casualties, and then there's the demonstrations, I actually saw for myself in a hospital 5 dead bodies shot during a demonstration. And this is stuff that, you know, the Iraqis know that it's going on, but it just doesn't make the news. And so this is what me and several other folks here are trying to focus on, because it's trying to be pushed under the carpet. And then you get into the factor where a lot of times people are killed and U.S. at a demonstration, and I know for a fact in the area of Baghdad where soldiers have gone in and sealed off the hospital and not let the families come claim the bodies unless they sign a form that says they were shot by Iraqi police and not U.S. soldiers. So it makes gathering statistics and getting down to the truth rather difficult. But as far as to sum up, the casualties are really high, and they're really particularly on Iraqis, and they're not diminishing as this goes on.
Dar Jamail is an independent freelance journalist. He's from Anchorage, Alaska, but is in Iraq to send information home about what's going on there, because it was his understanding that the mainstream press was not getting the news out. Dar, we're going to speak with you again, and I'm going to hope that we can get into a little bit of information about some of the people that you've been writing home about, because they seem to be people that you're getting to know well.
You know, I've worked with some really amazing people. My interpreter, for example, we've become really good friends. We spend almost every day together. And, you know, it's just, it's been one of the true highlights of me being here. He's been a really great guy. And in fact, if it weren't for him, I may not even be here today, because we've been in a couple of extremely tense situations at demonstrations where, you know, people just wanted some Westerner blood, and we just happened to be there. But thanks to him being able to do his job the right way, he saved my skin a couple of different times. And, yeah, you know, we've been in tense situations, and then we've also blow off steam together and laugh and joke. And we've become good friends, and it's going to make it extra hard to leave this place. And at the same time, it's going to be a big reason why I definitely want to come back.
Dar Jamail, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
If you would like to find articles by Dar Jamail, you can log on to the website electronicirac.net. For Regime Change Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program was produced in the studios of listener-supported WHUS, Radio for the People. If you would like to know more about this program or suggest a new topic for this radio show, please write to me at rcrradio@aol.com. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or of the University of Connecticut.